Yeah, OK.
All right, I'll start then. The Royal Meteorological Society is, through its specialist group in the history of meteorology, commissioning a series of interviews of distinguished British meteorologists. This is one of that series. It is an interview of Mr. J.S. Sawyer, held at the University of Bristol on the afternoon of Monday, the 12th of August, 1985. I, Dr. P.D. Drazin, am the interviewer. Well, perhaps I can begin by taking you back to your early life. I've got here your notes you prepared for the Royal Society, autobiographical notes, and they prompt various questions that perhaps I can persuade you to expand a bit upon. You talk of your school days at Alperton School and Latimer Upper School. I wonder if we can explore how you moved towards mathematics at the university and meteorology as a career. Did any master influence you in your attitude to science, to mathematics, or indeed to meteorology?
No. Of course, Latimer Upper School was a science-based school. Emphasis there very definitely was on science. There was a small arts side, but it was quite small. And so it was almost natural and inevitable that I took the usual courses leading up to the equivalent of GCE, the general schools as it then was, and the higher schools. And everybody who did so, or nearly everybody, studied mathematics, physics, and chemistry. And the this was the basic part of the education there. I mean, the art subjects, English and history and so on, were somewhat treated and somewhat less, with somewhat less emphasis. Right up to the age of 17 or so, when I took the higher schools examination, I had been taking the courses in mathematics, physics, and in chemistry. And in fact, I did, I think, pass the higher schools examination with more or less the same performance in all of them. So at that stage, there was no particular emphasis on mathematics, but I think Mr. Jackson, who was the senior mathematics master, was rather keen that somebody should have a go for a university scholarship in mathematics, and rather pressed me into it. I think mathematics had an appeal that I'd never thought my memory was particularly good, and you don't have to learn so much of sheer memory in mathematics. If you've got a basic idea of the proof, you could probably hatch it out for the examiners in some form or another. That, I think, led me to take a to go to Cambridge for the entrance scholarship examination, and having got an exhibition in mathematics, the rest more or less followed.
Did your family encourage you to go to university?
Not initially. In fact, they were a little bit horrified. It wasn't so much the custom to go to university in those days, but my father was a civil servant, an executive officer, and he was rather keen I should join the civil service, and original intention was that I'd leave school at 18 and take the civil service exam for the executive level. But having got a state scholarship, it was too good an opportunity to take it turned down, and he was quite pleased, I think, in the end, that I went on to the university. And indeed, I still took the examination for the administrative class of the civil service when I got my degree.
And that was through your father's interest and influence?
I suppose so, yes. But anyway, I got into the meteorological office rather independently of that, because they were simply advertising for scientific officers.
Well, can we perhaps move to Cambridge? You came with an exhibition in mathematics, and then made it natural for you to read in the mathematical tripos, was it, rather than physics or some other subject?
Yes, I think so. I don't know that it was assumed that I don't really think I gave much thought to it. I did consider doing natural sciences, but I was rather talked in anyway to continuing mathematics, and in any way, as I say, it didn't. I thought I might get on better without having to do so much memory work.
You went to Jesus College, Cambridge, where the mathematician in charge of the students was Mr. Powers. Now, I remember him as a kindly old gentleman in 1953. Perhaps you saw him in his younger days. Did he influence you? Would you like to say something about him?
I don't know that he influenced me a great deal. I was very friendly with him. He used to take me through. We used to go walks through the Cambridgeshire countryside. He would go out in his little car and go for a walk. But he wanted me to stay on actually and do research in mathematics. And I think he was a bit disappointed when I didn't.
Did he have any special idea, like it could be analytical dynamics? Or he just thought it was good for your development to do more mathematics at the university?
I can't recall that he had anything specific in mind. Of course, his own subject was interested in the theories of the complex variable, and my leaning certainly wasn't a pure mathematics.
Well, I wonder if I can ask you more about any of your contemporaries. I happen to have done a little homework and seen that C.H.B. Priestley was an exact contemporary of yours taking the Tripos. Well, that's a little remarkable to have two such meteorologists in the same year. Did you know him at all at Cambridge?
No, I didn't. In fact, this is the first time I knew that he'd actually taken the Tripos at the same time. No, curiously, I don't... although I must have been a contemporary with several people whom I subsequently met, I don't recall any of them at the time. Of course, there were quite a number of students in mathematics,
yes.
And they were spread through the colleges, and outside the lecture room you didn't meet a great many people outside your own college. So the tendency was perhaps to be more familiar with people in your own college than in the mathematics school.
Well, I don't know whether Priestley saw himself as a meteorologist at that time. Perhaps you didn't either. Did you have any special interest in meteorology? Anything from boyhood? Or?
No, I didn't really. The idea did crop up in my last year at Cambridge when we had to specialise in something for Part 3 of the Tripos, and I did the course in astronomy. And the lectures in combinational observations were given by Eddington, and he used Brunt's textbook on combinational observations and as the textbook, and that of course had some bearing on meteorology. I mean, the examples were meteorological.
Well, perhaps we can leave Cambridge and follow you to the meteorological office, and I suppose the war must have changed things a great deal, and in 1939 you went to the RAF base at Thorney Island, and there you must have interacted with a number of very eminent meteorologists. Perhaps think of Messrs. Sutcliffe, Durst and Gold. Could you tell us a little bit about them and your work there?
Sutcliffe was in fact at Thorney Island before the war, where he was lecturing to the RAF School of Navigators there, and but there wasn't a forecast office, or if there was, it was a small, very, very small one, and I was sent there to establish a forecast office, and Sutcliffe left soon afterwards to go, I think, to one of the Bomber Command meteorological offices. So that was the first time I met him, and subsequently we had some contact when he came down to Thorney Island to use his special knowledge and experience of Mediterranean meteorology to advise on the flight of some aircraft to Malta, which was particularly touchy because of the range of the aircraft. But during the war, of course, the meteorological outstations were very much independent of headquarters, and on the scientific side, the only contacts I really had were with C.S. Durst, who was running a very small investigations branch at the headquarters of the Meteorological Office, and various investigations he used to consult or write to outstations about. I remember particularly he was interested in sea breezes, which affected the landing conditions at airfields around the coast, and he wrote to the outstations for local experience on sea breezes and their onset, and also on the local occurrence of fog. And I had quite a correspondence with him about the fog at Thorny Island, which had some interesting characteristics. And that way I did get some scientific guidance from him, and it was a contact he knew of me. I also had some contact with Colonel Gold, who was then deputy director of the office, because Gold had designed the Gold visibility meter for measuring visibility at night. You used it to obscure a lamp until it disappeared, and visibility was determined from the necessary obscuration of the prism. But this was a bit of a snag, because of course there was a good deal of limitation on having lights at a distance in an airfield. You couldn't get them far enough away, really, and anyway they didn't like having them switched on. And I did find that it was possible to use the optical wedges of the Gold visibility meter to see when they obliterated the horizon, even when it was, you could always see the horizon if you let your eyes accommodate. And you could get an estimate of visibility from this. And I wrote to headquarters and told them about this, and as it was Gold's visibility meter, he took this up and sent me a large, several books on sight and seeing, and told me that I really didn't know quite what I was talking about. But anyway, it was an interesting contact with Gold, who took quite an interest in what I was doing.
Did he come down and see you on site, or was it just
by
correspondence?
It was just by correspondence. I went up and saw him once, I think. And
how was the research done in the office those days? Was it done by this miscellaneous interactions that you had with Durst and Gold, or was it all done at headquarters and people in the outstations were just doing forecasting or routine duties?
I don't think there was practically no organised research as such in the Meteorological Office. I think going back to, I think Sir George Simpson one time before the war opposed any organised research in the Meteorological Office on the grounds that if people were interested they would do the research anyway, and they ought to make the burden of on their scientific officers such that they had time to do their research. And I think he had worked to a principle that he did his administration in the morning and he did his research in the afternoon, and this may be hearsay, but this was his idea, that if you didn't load the scientific officers too hard, they would do some research. And there was in fact no organized research outside some specialist things like instruments, of course, and I think a certain amount in rainfall. But in the wartime things were coordinated a bit by the special investigations branch under Mr. Durst, who was a very active and far-seeing sort of person.
You mentioned at lunch, was it before lunch, about the means of making forecasts, isolated forecasts of doing. Perhaps you could tell us a little about that now, please.
Well, of course, the limited resources were very limited, and in the first months of the war, the number of forecasters trained was so limited that and the facilities so meagre that I found myself with three other people maintaining a 24-hour watch and producing the forecast required by three or four Air Force stations, with no more than a telephone, a pilot balloon theodolite, and also responsibility for making observations every hour. And it was surprising that in fact one could just about to take down all the synoptic messages over the telephone, plot them, take the observations every hour, put up a pilot balloon every 3 hours, and issue forecasts without any assistance. It's just about possible.
But perhaps some of the forecasts were better than others. Oh. The forecasters must have varied a great deal in their skills.
Yes, well, I wouldn't claim that that one was doing a great deal other than give the best advice that you could on the data that was available, and it was pretty meagre.
Yes.
But well, added to which, of course, it was all short period forecasting for aircraft at relatively low altitude.
Well, perhaps we can pass through the war, unless there's any other sort of occasion or person you'd like to talk about. I have in mind next going on to January 1946 when you joined Met 09, and perhaps your search career might have said to have begun with your work on the theory of tropical cyclones. Would you like to say anything about that work and how it arose, or is the written record enough?
Well, I don't know that. I think it's interesting, if nothing else, the way I got into Met 09. It was more or less by accident. I came back from India, having been ill there and sent back to recuperate. And then, during the period of demobilisation, I was rather kicking my heels. And I read some papers in the Quarterly Journal and wrote my first scientific paper, which was a critique, really, of the work by James and someone else.
Could be Pettersson.
Pettersson, yes, it was Pettersson. I sent it to Mr. Durst saying, how do I get this into the Quarterly Journal? And he said, oh, you're kicking your heels, I'd like you in Met 09. And within a few weeks, I found myself there. And so there, really, was a very fortunate start to my research career. It was a sort of odd job branch doing very ad hoc research, and a lot of my function there was writing climatological reports for aviation. But Mr. Durst was interested in tropical cyclones, and he'd written a very short paper about it before the war and said, had I any ideas what got them going? And I hadn't really, but I thought about it and wrote this paper on tropical cyclones, which was published in the Quarterly Journal. And I think that what I was trying to say, and I think it still has some validity, is that the cause has got to be seen in whatever causes the outflow at the top of the storm. And I tried to attribute this to what is now called dynamical instability, and I think that there's still some evidence that the occurrence of anticyclonic vorticity near the Coriolis parameter, nearly equal value to the Coriolis parameter at these levels in the tropical atmosphere, is a key to the setting off of the storms.
I would guess that that was a very sort of crucial stage in your scientific career, to have someone like Durst who was favourable to the climate of research and give you this encouragement. Do you feel that?
Well, I think it was I've got my interests and known within the Meteorological Office. There was another thing which probably I was asked to look into what was called pressure pattern flying, the ability of aircraft to use the radio altimeter and the pressure altimeter together to establish the pressure gradient and hence the wind. And there have been one or two papers about this, but I was asked to look at it, and I did publish a paper in which tidied this up and received some attention. And I think that also drew Sir Nelson Johnson's attention to me, and this made me a candidate for the forecasting research divisions when he sent them up at Dunstall in 1948, I think it was.
That's the 1949 paper of the Met Office Met Report number 3.
That's right.
Well, can we move on a bit to Meadow 31?
21.
That seems to me an important development in the way the Met Office was going, that way of Sir Nelson Johnson's vision of the future of meteorology. Would you like to tell us a little bit about the ideas behind the short and the longer term forecasting and your role in it?
Yes. Well, it certainly was an important step which the Meteorological Office took. I think that during the war, Sir Nelson Johnson had attempted to set up a small long-range forecasting research unit, which was led by C.E.P. Brooks, I think. But it didn't get very far, and it ended up being disbanded soon after the war. And this was the first attempt that the office had had to establish a forecasting research division. It was under Dr. Sutcliffe, and there were two branches, one under me on short-range forecasting research and the other on long-range forecasting. Long-range, by the way, at that time only meant 2 or 3 days. And or at least that was the way that Sutcliffe interpreted it.
And what was short? What was short? Short range?
Well, up to 24 hours. And Sutcliffe started the division with a very definite interest in the use of the thickness pattern between 1,000 and 500 millibars as indication of the thermal structure, and the used in conjunction with the 500 millibar charts. And in fact, the way the division started was to start drawing these charts, which were over as much of the northern hemisphere as possible. And in fact, until then, we had hardly seen them. It was only possible at that time because the radio sonde network established during the war had become available. And and of course Sutcliffe's own paper on the theory of development had shown the importance of the thickness pattern taken with the flow pattern in establishing the criteria for development of depressions and anticyclones. And it was very much in his mind to establish just how far his techniques could be used and test them out in practice. As when I got to Dunstable, one of the first things that I tried to do with Sutcliffe's encouragement was to try and put some numbers into the actual mathematics of Sutcliffe's theory of development. And this we did primarily by graphical methods, because if you'll recall at that time most of the upper air charting was done by the graphical addition of the thickness pattern to the pressure pattern at lower levels, building up from 1,000 millibars to the higher levels. And the same methods of a graphical addition and subtraction could be well adapted to evaluating the vorticity and the advection of vorticity and so forth. And this in fact led to some very encouraging calculations, graphical calculations, of the pattern of vertical motion as indicated by Sutcliffe's theory, by the relation of course between divergence and vertical motion and the rate of change of divergence and vorticity. And that really started us on the direction of numerical forecasting.
Well, I just happen to have here a paper in front of me that you gave to the centenary meeting of the Royal Meteorological Society in 1950. The title was An Example of Cyclogenesis in Relation to Sutcliffe's Theory of Development. That was a sort of brief synopsis of your work at that time in this direction, I suppose.
Yes, I think the interesting thing was that Sutcliffe's emphasis had been on the thickness pattern and its role in determining the areas of cyclogenesis and anticyclogenesis. Not so much on the 500 millibar pattern, but at that time the ideas of the barotropic model and the 500 millibar pattern were coming out from Rossby in America, and I think that 1950 paper really tried to draw the threads together and set the pattern for developing a two-parameter model in which both the if you like, the barotropic effect of the the barotropic ideas applied to the 500 millibar pattern were combined with Sutcliffe's ideas of development related to the thickness pattern.
It was a fine opportunity, I would reckon, for a young man to give a talk about that subject to such a meeting. Were there a lot of people from abroad there? Did your work excite some response from them?
I have no very clear recollection. There were quite a lot of people from abroad, but at that time, of course, we're only gradually, I suppose, beginning to get familiar with the American side and the other people from abroad. After all, development of meteorology in the UK had been very much a national thing. The international contacts had not been, well, they were disturbed in 1939 and hadn't altogether been re-established. But that was a beginning, but I can't say that I knew a great many of the people from abroad at that time, and although I think quite a number were there.
Yes, but perhaps many from Europe and maybe not so many from across the Atlantic because of the relative expense of travel?
No, I think it was more from across the Atlantic. I don't recall many from Europe, because Europe, of course, was still recovering from the war.
Well, you said earlier this afternoon that Richardson wrote to you about 1950, it's Lewis Fry Richardson. I think any anecdote about such a man is of interest. Can you tell us a little bit about the nature of your correspondence, or whether you met him or not?
No, I didn't meet him, but when he had heard that attempts were being made at numerical weather prediction, he wrote to me completely out of the letter came completely out of the blue, and asked me if we considered using his technique of deferred approach to the limit in the carrying out of the numerical forecast. This was the effect, really. He had published a paper about this many years earlier, and basically the idea was to use a coarse grid for the initial calculations, to use a finer grid, and then to extrapolate the towards the finer, still finer grid by using the results of these two different meshes. We hadn't done anything about it, but it was, and I wrote to him acknowledging it, and it was obviously very relevant, but we didn't in fact use it. He also sent me some papers drawing my attention to his proposal to measure the wind by shooting a gun upwards and finding where the bullets dropped. But that was the end of the correspondence. We didn't hear any more. I didn't hear any more after that.
Well, in the copy of biographical notes here, you really just give a short paragraph to your work on airflow over hills, which must have taken place in the early 50s. Does that express your view of its relative importance to your other work? Would you like to say anything about that phase of your interest?
Well, I think it was rather an aside. It was, of course, there was considerable interest because of the potential hazard to aircraft. Professor Scorer, of course, had written some very important papers and on the flow of air over hills, particularly the formation of lee waves. And there were certain uncertainties in the mathematics as to how the upper boundary condition affected matters. And I think I started doing that partly because at that time we were getting a computer available for our use for numerical weather prediction. And I wanted to experiment and see how useful it could be in other aspects of meteorology. And this is how the matter came up. It was a rather short phase of my interests. But ultimately, of course, I think it was important in or significant in drawing attention to the question of how hills ultimately exert their drag on the atmosphere as a whole, because the Lee waves may be more important in establishing a flow of momentum to the ground.
Well, if many people have used that earlier work, haven't they, to find the exchange of angular momentum through the atmosphere and the Earth and so forth.
Yes.
Well, you also in that work got involved in a controversy with Scorer, was it Scorer and lots of other people. And I confess I, as a young man, read the discussions and the correspondence in the Quarterly Journal at that time, and I read it with some amazement. Any subsequent thoughts on the nature of that discussion?
I don't, as you make it sound as if it was an acrimonious discussion. I don't think it was. I think it was primarily concerned on the choice of the upper boundary condition in the mathematics. And I think that has now ultimately been resolved. I really, frankly, would have difficulty now in reconstructing the arguments one way or the other.
I thought people...
I think that there were other people involved at Dunstable in the forecasting research division, Mr. Wallington and Corby in particular. And I think, in fact, we did resolve it by some rather... I think rather inelegant methods of doing it.
When you took the lid and let it go.
Yes, exactly.
And I think Palm also joined in the correspondence about the group loss to the energy transport.
That's right. I think that Palm had a much more fundamental and elegant ideas about it than we did, but I think we came to the same answer. My recollection is Scorer was on the other side.
Well, yes, he was. Well, perhaps I can go back to your career and 1960, when you became deputy director of the Office for Dynamical Research. That seems to me a crucial decision in your career, when you were taking on a job that must you must have known would involve you a lot more with administration. Did you hesitate in it? Accepting that promotion? Did you have any thoughts about it you'd care to recall?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it was an expansion of of my responsibilities and interests, I didn't really have much hesitation about it. It brought me very much more into the international sphere, and I have always found that very interesting and helpful. Of course, it left me, it took me out, if you like, of the detailed work in numerical weather prediction, but it still remained under my direction, and although I didn't interfere more than I perhaps should have done, it was, all the major decisions on which way to go and what to develop came to me, so that I was very much involved. And in fact, I remember it was just after that we more or less took the decision to abandon the to drop the research on the geostrophic models and go over to the primitive equations as the basis for a numerical prediction. I think one of the first things I did when we went to Bracknell was to get Rowntree to look into the problems of solving the primitive equations, which were already being done in America, but we hadn't any experience of them. And This suggested using, and I suggested using a detailed model with a rather finer grid for studying the structure of fronts and so on, and this went ahead. because clearly the geostrophic models are not going to tell you very much about frontal structure. Originally, this was started as more or less a theoretical development, but the model was soon adapted for application to real synoptic situations and was the basis of the so-called fine mesh model that was used for many years in the meteorological office.
So they pressed for the use of primitive equation models, both as a scientist and as an administrator. And did you were you actually involved with the detail work on any primitive equation model, or that was done by others at the time?
Mostly it was done by others. I started off investigating some of the stability problems, but it soon became apparent that other people got much more time and could do it much better, and I dropped out of that.
Well, I guess time must have been at a premium for you in the 60s. But I wonder if I can digress a bit of talking about the various directors of the Meteorological Service in your time of employment there. First, Sir George Simpson, then Sir Nelson Johnson, Sir Graham Sutton, and lastly, Sir John Mason. Perhaps I can get you to expand upon each in turn. Did you know Sir George Simpson at all? Did you meet him? Or was he just a big name?
No,
a young man then?
He was. I didn't really... I met him, of course, but I didn't really... I mean, I didn't really have any effective contact with him. It's interesting, of course, that... I don't know, probably some other your interviewees will recall that before the war, he instituted at South Kensington Monday meetings, I think it was Monday evening, in the library at South Kensington, where a scientific paper was taken and discussed, and I went attended several of these in my early days in the office. He used to select a scientific paper from usually a foreign journal and send it to some scientific officer in the office and ask him to present this and open a discussion on it at a tea party which he gave at South Kensington on Mondays once a month, I think, during the winter. It was quite an interesting institution.
Sounds a jolly good idea. Was he active in the discussion? Was Brunt active in the discussion? Gold?
I don't really recall the details. I believe so. Gold was always active in any discussion that was going on.
You talked a bit about Sir George Simpson's view of science as a rather amateurish pursuit of individuals doing what they thought appropriate. Did other ideas of his about how the office should be run come down to you?
Not really, no. I mean, I think at the time I was there, he was very much concerned with the expansion of the office to meet the expansion of the Air Force. And, well, it was, he must have retired only a couple of years after I joined the office.
Well, perhaps we can go on to Sir Nelson Johnson. You must have had rather more to do with him as you rose in the service. Can you tell us anything about him as a man, or, again, what he thought the office was to be doing in the crucial time during the war?
Well, I don't know that I had a great deal of contact with him. I think his period of directorship was primarily the wartime period, and of course contacts within the office were limited then, and the opportunities of going to headquarters from an outstation were quite limited. So I really saw very little of him. I saw saw more of him, of course, in the couple of years I was at Met 09. But even so, I was quite a junior member of the staff, and one didn't really know a great deal. He came while I was in... In India, at the as part of the meteorological headquarters serving the Air Force there, he came out to India, and mainly to tell the then director, Sir Charles Norman, of the Indian Meteorological Service, that the Met Office was going to send out a large number of forecasters for the extension of the war against Japan, when it was expected that that would go ahead after the end of the war in Europe. But in fact, of course, although a large number of forecasters came out, the war terminated with the atomic bombs.
Well, Sir Nelson Johnson set up your shorter-term forecasting group.
Yeah.
Did he pay an interest in your scientific results, or look at it rather than an administrator? And was he curious about what you were doing? And
I think he was always a very interested scientist. But I think he, one way or another, he had relatively little opportunity to. I mean, he was always a an active participant in the Meteorological Research Committee, I think, but he didn't take any active part in the meteorology, as far as I know, during his term of office. But this was no doubt through circumstances of the time.
Well, perhaps we can come on to Sir Graham Sutton next. I don't think we've said anything about him yet in the discussion. What sort of man was he? How did you meet him? You must have done.
Oh, yeah.
What sort of decisions were you involved with him?
Of course, I any decisions really would come second hand, because Sutcliffe was my immediate superior through most of my career, and Sutcliffe was very definitely had his finger on the research pulse, and I think Sir Graham Sutton didn't query this. I mean, I think that Sir Graham Sutton had an interest, but I don't think that he really attempted to exert very much influence on the way that research did. Of course, Sutcliffe had the research program very much under his thumb.
Was this a sort of special policy for Sutcliffe, or did Sutton believe in appointing a good man and let him get on with the job?
I think he did. because Sutton had very wide interests. I mean, he came to the office after having been professor at Shrivenham, and he'd written a book on the theory of flight, hasn't he?
Yes.
And quite a number of texts. I think his interests were more as a, if you like, an academic teacher than as a, by the time he came to the office, was more interested in being an academic teacher in meteorology for the time which he wanted to devote to it, rather than an active researcher. And I don't think that he attempted to exert any influence on the research program at that stage, apart from putting his view in at the research committee meetings and so on.
As far as I can gather, the major development under Sutton's term was the move to Bracknell.
Yes.
Would that be fair?
Yes. Of course, he was very instrumental in getting the finance for the office computer. Having the first computer, he was very actively involved and very keen that that should go ahead.
Policy for Sutcliffe, or did Sutton believe in appointing a good man and let him get on with the job?
I think he did. because Sutton had very wide interests. I mean, he came to the office after having been professor at Shrivenham. And he'd written a book on the theory of flight, hasn't he?
Yes.
And quite a number of texts. I think his interests were more as a, if you like, an academic teacher than as a, by the time he came to the office, he was more interested in being an academic teacher in meteorology for the time which he wanted to devote to it, rather than an active researcher. And I don't think that he attempted to exert any influence on the research program at that stage, apart from putting his view in at the research committee meetings and so on.
As far as I can gather, the major development under Sutton's term was the move to Bracknell. Yes. Would that be fair?
Yes. Of course, he was very instrumental in getting the finance for the office computer. Having the first computer, he was very actively involved and very keen that that should go ahead. I mean, I think with somebody perhaps less pushy in that field, we shouldn't have got it so soon.
So which computer was this then that he
This was the Ferranti Mercury, yes, which was installed at Dunstanmore in, I think, 1959.
And did Sutton get new computers to come at Bracknell? Presumably
yes,
he got the
yes,
first
one. He was quite keen. We had the Ferranti Mercury at Bracknell, and then this was replaced by the KDF-9 at Mercury was installed at Dunstable, moved to Bracknell in 61, and then it ran there for two or three years, and it was replaced by the KDF-9. The Ferranti Mercury was a very useful machine, and it was the fastest we could get at the time, but it was never really quite adequate to provide a forecast in useful time with the sort of resolution and area that we needed. And so, for a long time, the forecasts were produced daily, but they were more, if you like, operational guidance than actually being taken by the forecaster as ultimate answer.
Well, moving on to Sir John Mason, perhaps I always think of him as the man that pushed ahead enormously with computers in the office. But it's interesting that Sir Graham Sutton was starting it before. But can you tell us a little bit about some of the developments under Sir John Mason, ones which I'm sure you must have been very much a party to?
Well, in a way, curiously, perhaps not. The first two computers, the Mercury and KDF-9, were basically bought to carry on the research. But by the time, and in fact, when Sir John Mason came on the scene, we were just about, the KDF-9 was just coming into use and producing regular forecasts of such a standard that there was no doubt that they were the main guidance, and in fact were more or less taken by the forecaster as being definitive predictions.
So the KDF-9 parts were used as a basis for operational forecasts?
Oh, yes, they very much were. And I seem to recall that it was just about the time that Sir John Mason took over that that they were coming in to as more or less definitive forecasts. but also at that time, because the computer role was becoming an essential part of the forecasting role, the control of the computer and its ancillaries and so forth moved from the research side of the house to the services side of the house. And so, although I was interested after that, the actual choice of computer and making a case for it and so forth was made entirely on service ground after that, and not so much on research grounds.
But the research people would use the computer?
Oh yes, it was always envisaged, yes, that there had to be sufficient time available for research, but operational use of the computer was its main function, and took, I would say, probably more than 50% of its time anyway. So that the research aspects became less of a criterion and it was no longer under my direction.
And I guess the Ministry of Defence would be more convinced by an argument based on operational needs to justify the expense of a new computer.
Yes, in fact, justification shifted entirely. I mean, we justified the first computer, the Ferranti Mercury, simply on the basis that if we were going to continue the research, it would cost us more to hire time on a computer than buy one of our own. This was sufficient to justify buying the machine. But by the time you got to the IBM machine which followed the KDF-9, 360 series, the justification was pure, it became entirely operational.
Well, nonetheless, there must have been lots of other decisions about where research should go. Can you pick out any highlights there, looking now in the 60s?
Well, of course, one aspect of research which is the long-range forecasting climatic change aspect. Numerical forecasting began to extend a bit beyond 24 hours to 48 hours and so on. Originally, when we had a short-range forecasting branch and a long-range forecasting branch under Sutcliffe, long-range forecasting meant 48 hours to 3 or 4 days. But we began to realize that there was a problem beyond that, and really long-range forecasting for a month or a season, something ought to be done about this. And at Dunstable, we tried to establish the sort of archives and that we'd need for an analog system of forecasting. And this is a very long-term business. We built up a set of maps of the temperature anomalies, pressure anomalies, and so forth, going back over many years, and this has continued ever since. The analog forecasts were not very good, although we thought, and I still think they showed some slight improvement over chance. And then in the very cold winter of 62-63, I think it was.
Yes, 62-63. 63-64, also very cold.
Yes, 62-63, I think, was the one. The press got very agitated because Namias in America had issued monthly forecasts, and they got hold of some of these, which said that the cold winter would continue. And discussions with the press at various times had told them we were doing research on this subject, and we got into the very awkward position that if we didn't publish, the press were going to ask why we had been doing it for so many years and continuing, and we hadn't got any results. What was the justification of continuing any further? And on the other hand, if we did publish, the results weren't very good, but in the end, it was decided that we should publish, and then the monthly forecast started from there onwards. But whether they were of very much help at all, it may not have been, may not have done anybody a great deal of good, but it did, I think, mean that the data on this timescale were looked at and were mapped, and they were available, and I'm sure that those data and the experience gained is now important and is likely to be important in understanding the climate and understanding climatic change. Because unless you look at things on a big scale and look at the way anomalies develop and have got some data about it to test theories and so on, you're not going to make a great deal of progress. So I don't really regret it, although there's a lot of time went in producing long-range forecasts, but not a great deal of
Was the decision to publish against your wishes? Did you feel that the office was being forced?
Well, I don't know. I think that there were advantages in publishing. It's very easy when you've been looking at something like this for some time, just go on in one way and not to. If once you publish, you've got to justify your results, you've got to take the kicks, and it does sharpen up people's appreciation and encourage them to look at new aspects and so on. I think it's. No, I didn't regret the publishing really, although it was. I mean, one could have had a quieter life if they'd gone on without being published.
Yes, I threw a few less letters in the Times, yes, about your activities. Well, but again, when did you stop publishing? Was that before you retired?
No, it was afterwards. It must have been about 1977 or thereabouts, I think.
So then again, you weren't involved in
that? I wasn't involved
in that,
no.
Well, let's just think, see what my notes here say. Perhaps I can ask you what you think of developments in the office since you've retired. Have you paid any attention to them, or you more or less feel you've gone and...
I think it would be inappropriate. No, I don't really don't know enough. I mean, I'm very impressed by the computer power and what it manages to produce. I'm sure that the... But I wouldn't like to comment beyond that.
Well, then perhaps I can move you on to different forms of service in your career. That's first with the Royal Meteorological Society. You've served that society in a number of ways, from relatively early ones up to the president. You must have been interested in society to have given that much time. Can you talk about any things you've done there from the earliest days?
No, I've always found being the activities of the society a very rewarding thing to be involved with, but it's been perhaps a bit on my conscience that not as editor or president could I say that I had really started anything or innovated anything. I think perhaps that's in my nature, to carry on things as they are and not to be too dissatisfied with anything. I think under my presidency things carried on very much as they had done, and I'm not going to claim any startling innovations. Most of the things that came to fruition then, like the separation of the Canadian branch and things like that, were more or less in train before I got there.
Well, how about the Royal Society? I read you've been on various committees. I don't quite know what. Anything there you think of particular worthy of mention?
I don't know. I mean, I'm afraid my role perhaps has been very much the same. Of course, I suppose perhaps I've been... my role has often been to be less than enthusiastic about some of other people's ideas and try and put an air of realism into some of the ideas that were put forward. I mean, the Jason experiment, for example, took a very long time to get going, and at one time I felt it was getting organized a bit on the wrong lines, but in the end it produced some very, very good results.
See, you joined in the organization of that as a representative of the office.
Well, I was involved in the organization of that, but a lot of my activities with the society was as a representative, the ex officio representative of the office on the various committees and so on.
Has Jason had any input into operational models since those days?
I think it's told us a good deal about boundary layer over the sea, which is what its objective was, but I think you'd have to ask the people who have been more recently involved in the formulation of the boundary layer in models to say whether the actual experiment has had much effect. I doubt if it has yet, but it may yet do so.
Perhaps I can go back to other aspects of research. Your biographical notes mention not much influence from abroad. You talked at the centenary meeting and saying how British meteorology was rather a world of itself, and I suppose that each country had its own meteorologists perhaps looking at one another. Yet nonetheless, you must have been influenced by works from foreign meteorologists and by meeting them and so forth.
Yes, I think we were influenced by Rossby's group, of course. The idea of using the 500 millibar chart and the regarding movements of the and changes in the 500 millibar chart as the effect of the barotropic model, that we absorbed from Rossby and his group. And of course our first attempts at applying numerical methods were when Fred Bushby joined us at Dunstable, and the first thing I think he did was to try and repeat some of the barotropic calculations which followed, which were given in a paper, now I can't remember who it was, whether it was the, I think it was from the group which involved Firtoft and Bolin and, but I can't remember which of them published the paper.
Could it be von Neumann, Charm and Firtoft in Tellus?
That's the one, yes, that's the one, yes, in which they used a effectively a one-dimensional barotropic model around the hemisphere. And when Bushby joined us at Dunstable, that was the first thing he did, was to see whether we could repeat that with different synoptic situations and convince ourselves how far it worked. And that started us off in the numerical prediction business.
Was the influence by what you read or by meeting?
Largely by what we read. We had some visitors at Dunstable, and Rossby came there on one occasion. I met von Neumann and Firtoft and Bolin in the States at the time of the Met Society's meeting in Canada. I don't know whether that was about 1951, was it, or something about that.
Well, in your notes, I confess I don't.
But I don't remember. I wouldn't say that personal contact had so much influence. The amusing fact that I think Phil Thompson came over from the States when we were doing our first calculations of thickness tendency numerically, and he was, I think, quite impressed by the ability of the Sutcliffe-Tychel model to calculate the rate of change of thickness or temperature in the atmosphere. And he went back to the States and subsequently published a two-parameter prediction model in the Quarterly Journal. At the same time, Fred Bushby and I published one in the Journal of Meteorology. I think ours received more attention because it was shorter and more readable. His was much more academic, and I've never seen it quoted so much, but essentially the ideas were the same.
I've never Rossby, but by all accounts he was a powerful and impressive man. Did he strike you as such when he visited Dunstable, or was he a bit whisked around by to see the director and so forth?
I think he impressed me. Only thing I have a very clear recollection of was an argument over lunch with him in which I was advocating the use of numerical predictions as improving the forecast of 24 hours ahead or thereabouts, and Rossby said this was quite wrong, that they weren't going to be much good there, but they were going to revolutionize the forecasts for several days ahead. I do recall that.
Can you remember why he believed that?
He regarded it, I think he believed it was very much more important. I don't think he thought that producing a forecast for 24 hours was all that important.
Oh, I see. It wasn't that the means of doing it, but of the desirability of the end.
Yeah, it's partly that, I think. And I think partly he thought that, extrapolation and so forth was not getting on too badly to 24 hours, but it couldn't get any further.
Mm. How about von Neumann? Again, he has sort of legendary stories about him. Did you have any anecdotes in you about him?
No, I not really. I met him once in Princeton, but no, I haven't.
Well, perhaps we can move on to your service on the WMO committees. You seem to have done sterling work in many capacities, the WMO. And I sense you enjoyed the work.
Oh, I did, yes. I think it... it was quite interesting, and but I think my role more was to keep people's feet on the ground and try and tell people what was realistically could be done, rather than start any great innovations.
Well, perhaps that's an important part of an innovation.
Well, I think there's quite a role to be done in picking amongst the various ideas those which can be carried out and usefully be done from those which are harebrained and are only going to bring the activities into disrepute.
Did you think GARP was in danger of leading to something not very practical?
No, I hope that GARP was in the end a very successful enterprise. Certainly, it got a lot of things done which would not otherwise have been done. These things could only be done when the climate was right, so to speak. I mean, the idea of the GATE experiment in the tropical Atlantic got off the ground and really was effectively carried out. But this was, the thing had been in the air. The Commission for Aerology had tried to get something started in the Southwest Pacific some years before, but the time wasn't ripe. And although one wrote a lot of papers about it, I think these things can, so to speak, only be done when the time is just right, and it's the practicality of the projects which is almost more important than their scientific conception.
I would guess the existence of the jet plane must have made these things much easier for people to move around.
Oh, well, I'm sure it did. I mean, after all, at the outbreak of war, the Met Society was having a joint meeting in Canada, wasn't it, with the American Meteorological Society, or was it in the States? Anyway, I mean, everybody had to go by ship, and it was quite a long time before they got back. I mean, that's all.
Seems you're always giving a whole summer to the meeting.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps I'm coming near the end of my questions, but let me invite you to choose some other line of discussion, or to volunteer some opinions of some other aspect of meteorology, of meteorologists, or the organisation of meteorology in the office.
I don't know. I think I've given you most of the anecdotes and things which occur to me. I don't know that there's a great deal else that I would need to say. We haven't talked about climatic change and so forth, and such problems as the potential effect of human activities on the atmosphere and climate, which I feel is an important field, but one of these in which it's essential to be realistic. And I think that the meteorologists, once upon a time, meteorologists could go their way and carry out their research without too much pressure upon them. And I think that the difficulty now is that there is real pressure to answer the questions as to what effect pollutants have on climate, and I suppose such effects as the effect of an atomic war on the atmosphere. And I think that it's difficult to for these to be given the sort of independent consideration that they require. They fortunately, they tend to draw in people who have more interest, but only sort of partial knowledge of the atmosphere, and a meteorologist his role may well be to try and make sure that all the knowledge of the atmosphere is brought to bear on these problems, and not merely the somewhat partial insights of people with an enthusiasm or an interest in one particular aspect.
I seem to remember work on CO2 in the atmosphere being done in the office in the 70s, so there must have been a fair amount of interest of these sort of questions in your time there.
Yes, I did. The office really never did any interest, did any work in this field. We tried to assess what was going on elsewhere.
I see. It was more.
It was more an assessment of what was going on elsewhere. But I think up to that time, I mean, the thing was more or less of an academic interest pursued by people who had the time and interest to take it at the pace which the subject demanded. Unfortunately, these things tend to get pressed ahead rather more. It becomes more difficult, I imagine, as the pressure for an answer increases.
Well, yes, perhaps one needs a bit of long-term and short-term research on such subjects. Well, would you like to take my invitation even any further? Any other?
No, I think you've exhausted me, if I might say so.
Well, all right. Thank you very much, Mr. Sawyer. Thank you. Well,
yes, was that enough?
Well, yes, I think that's fine. Yes.